Today is July 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Philip Alexio in Washington, D.C. Coming up, no resolution in sight between the U.S. and Russia over seized Russian compounds. The U.S. hits Iran with more sanctions after accusing groups of backing Tehran's ballistic missile program.
It's going to discourage capital inflows into Iran. Number two, it's going to make domestic investment even weaker than it is likely to be.
A Syrian artist depicts life in Raqqa under Islamic State, and also ahead, teen robot builders from around the world compete in an international robot face-off. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. Russia says it reserves the right to retaliate in an ongoing dispute with the U.S. over the seizure of two Russian compounds last December by the Obama administration. Before leaving office, then-President Barack Obama also expelled 35 Russian diplomats, accusing them of spying and saying that the actions were to punish Moscow for interfering in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Now, Russia says its patience is running out, and it wants the Trump administration to return the compounds. VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has the story from the State Department.
Russia says they are dachas, used strictly for recreational purposes. U.S. intelligence agencies say they were used for surveillance until they were seized. Pressed by reporters, spokeswoman Heather Nauert refused to comment on the status of negotiations or say whether Secretary of State Rex Tillerson favors giving the compounds back to Russia under certain conditions.
I wouldn't characterize it that way. And look, one of the priorities here is, or the priority here, is to get the United States and Russia to a place where they can have a good, decent, solid relationship so we can work together on areas of mutual cooperation.
Russia is still threatening to retaliate in kind.
This fits standard Soviet and then Russian diplomatic practice. When we catch their spies and expel them, they immediately expel the same number of American diplomats. So they never acknowledge their culpability. And when we take steps to deal with egregious actions on their part, they always take countersteps. It's simply the way they do business.
Herbst said Moscow could retaliate in several different ways.
Well, we also have dachas, or at least had a single dacha in Russia. Conceivably, they could take that away. I remember when Obama took these steps, there was speculation that they were going to close down the major school used by our embassy's children. That would be very nasty indeed. And I would hope and expect that that would prompt a very strong reaction by us if they were to do that.
Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov met Monday at the State Department with U.S. Under Secretary of State Thomas Shannon. Asked if Russia is close to getting its compounds back, Ryabkov replied, almost. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
And it is about 9 minutes past the hour, and that is time now for our social media expert Andrew Pachesky to step in here and tell us what's going on the trend line, my friend.
What's on the trend line? Well, it seems like every day on the trend line is something about Russia, and as Cindy was just talking about, Russia continues to be a big story. The other big story here in the U.S. is healthcare that we've been talking about all week. And it's a big story today because President Trump is meeting with Republican senators and they're having a lunch meeting to talk about where they go from here. Of course, the repeal and replace effort failed in the Senate. The just repeal and replace later effort failed in the Senate. So now they have to reassess what they're doing. And Trump tweeting out earlier today, the Republicans never discuss how good their healthcare bill is and it will get even better at lunchtime. The Dems scream death as Ocare dies. So Trump very confident there in Twitter, in the Twitterverse, that after this lunch meeting, they'll have a plan to go forward with on health care. But lots of speculation on social media and questions about whether that'll actually happen over lunch.
All it takes is a lunch.
All it takes is a lunch.
Why didn't
Who knew?
They do that before?
Who knew? All you need is lunch.
Sorry. And what else do you have?
Well, heading out west in the U.S. to the state of Arizona, you have Senator Jeff Flake, who's up for re-election in 2018. And there's a woman who's running against him named Deidre Abood. And Deidre Abood is Muslim. And after she announced she was running for Senate, got some hate speech online thrown at her, some threats. So Jeff Flake did something rare in this political climate. He showed bipartisanship and compassion for his opponent, the woman who's trying to run to replace him. And he tweeted out at her, "Hang in there, Deirdre 2018. That's her Twitter account for her campaign. "Sorry you have to put up with this. Lots of wonderful people across Arizona. You'll find them." So many people praising Senator Jeff Flake for defending his political opponent and striking out against hate speech. A lot of people online noting that Jeff Flake refused to support President Trump during the election campaign of that Muslim ban, and President Trump has been working with some Republicans to try to oust Senator Jeff Flake in the primaries before that general election. But lots of praise for the senator over his bipartisanship there and tackling hate speech.
All right, good for him. And something going on in Saudi Arabia, right?
Yes.
Some video or something?
Yes, a story I talked about with our colleague Lori London. A young woman in Saudi Arabia went viral after a video went up on Snapchat where she's walking around in a mini skirt and a shirt that exposes her stomach. Of course, that's in violation of Saudi Arabia's strict dress code for women. She was arrested for that, and I did a video as part of my Digital Daily series where I talked about, well, there's so much attention on this on social media, maybe it'll mitigate some of the punishments. Maybe she'll get away without getting punished because of all the social media attention. And that's exactly what happened. She was released by authorities, and they said there's been so much scrutiny on this that they weren't going to charge her. So I correctly predicted that in my video. As I said before we went on air, I'm not always right, but when I am, I gotta emphasize it.
And maybe you have more influence than you actually think you have.
Maybe. I don't know. I'll take it. But everybody can check out the video. It's on Facebook.com/#VOA and @#VOA on Twitter.
All right. Excellent. All right, Andrew Paczewski. Neat stuff there. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right. You're listening to International Edition. Among the top stories in the world, an Arab-Kurdish feud deepens as fears mount over the battle for Raqqa. Iran's president saying he will now stand up to the United States over the new sanctions. American foster families will soon be united with young refugees from Somalia and Eritrea. And Indonesia sounds a soft warning in renaming part of the disputed South China Sea. All those stories we've got on voanews.com. You can go to our VOA mobile app as well. You're listening to International Edition. Where the United States slaps sanctions on 18 Iranian individuals and groups that it accuses of backing Tehran's ballistic missile program, even after the U.S. recertified Iranian compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert said that Iran remains one of the most dangerous threats to the United States and a threat to the Middle East region.
Ballistic missile development and proliferation, support to terrorism and militancy, it's complicit in the Assad regime's atrocities against its own people, unrelenting hostility to Israel that continues and has continued for quite some time. They have consistently threatened freedom of navigation, especially in the Persian Gulf. Cyber attacks on the United States, and I can go on. I mean, these are no surprise, and this is something that this administration wants to get Iran to try to adhere to the spirit of that agreement.
Well, the sanctions freeze any assets the targeted Iranians might have in the U.S. and block Americans from doing business with them. VOA's Victor Beatty talks with Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal to get his view on the U.S. actions.
I think what is important to remember is that the United States obviously has implicitly contradictory objectives in the region as far as Iran is concerned. Now, because of that, it's inevitable that when you do one thing which may be considered as positive, as in the case of the nuclear agreement and its ratification, there is a problem on the other hand. The problem is that the American and the Iranian interests do not converge on other issues. And for that reason, the American position and the American decisions will have a fairly significant impact, not a short-term impact, but certainly a much longer impact. The impact will be of the following nature. Remember that the Iranians were looking forward to easing of economic restrictions and opening up of the American investors going into Iran for investment purposes, and other European and other investors who usually look at the United States for a cue before they go in. So under the circumstances, my concern is these actions that have been taken are going to have two-pronged effects. One is going to discourage capital inflows into Iran. Number two, it's going to make domestic investment even weaker than it is likely to be. Now, under these circumstances, Iran, which is already on a fairly low growth trajectory, is going to get onto even a lesser growth trajectory, which is dangerous for several reasons. One of those is that it tends to increase income inequality and a political dichotomy in the region, in the country particularly. What happens is that the more powerful, the ultra-conservative, get an excuse for continuing to maintain their anti-American and anti-Western attitude. What that will mean is will weaken the new government, which has recently been re-elected, number one. Number two, they tend to siphon off even more resources out of the declining resource availability for their own purposes. And that means that there's a greater degree, likelihood of dichotomy in the economy growing and becoming worse, which is dangerous because it strengthens the hands of the conservatives and weaken the hands of the liberals. And therefore, liberals who could likely be considered as supportive of integration with the global economy will find themselves in a situation where they won't be able to do it. So under these circumstances, the forces that will be unleashed will likely be not particularly beneficial for the American longer-term interests.
The State Department said the U.S. remains deeply concerned about Iran's malign activities across the Middle East, which undermine regional stability, security, and prosperity. Do they have a point?
Yes and no. Look, I mean, the point, as I said earlier, we have on our hands a very difficult situation. We have contradictory objectives. Yes, we certainly would like the Iranians to help in the process of controlling the nuclear proliferation, number one, and number two, help in the process of containing and controlling, eliminating the influence of the Islamic State. The point, though, is once you defeat the Islamic State, what happens? A vacuum is created. Who walks into that vacuum? Iranians are certainly much more organized, and they've got a lot more resources than others, and the likelihood is that Al-Quds and other forces which are under the Revolutionary Guard's control are likely to move in those places. So the point is, we have already created a situation on our hands where the Iranian position becomes stronger. And if the regional Iranian position becomes stronger, then we will have to act in a much more aggressive fashion in order to contain their impact on the American interests.
That's Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Images of life under Islamic State rule are rare because taking photos, drawing, or painting was discouraged or even banned. An artist who escaped from Raqqa, an Islamic State stronghold in Syria, which is now under siege, depicts scenes from the occupied city in a temporary shelter where he now lives. VOA's Lattice Ahok reports Faisal's drawings and paintings are rare historic documents as well as works of art.
Faisal is not his real name. He is a Syrian farmer who has loved painting all his life. But when Islamic State took control over the area where he lived, he was forced to hide all his work and his painting tools.
When Islamic State came, they closed down libraries and shops selling CDs, music and movies. Anything that has to do with singing, dancing, drawing, or music was forbidden. I also play the oud, but I don't have it anymore. The militants broke it before I fled.
Faisal left his home northeast of the city about 3 months ago and found refuge with his wife and children in the Ain Issa camp. He is one of tens of thousands of Syrian civilians who have fled Raqqa since the beginning of the U.S.-backed offensive to retake the city. At the camp, he has made improvised tools in order to return to his art. Pillow feathers for paintbrushes and cigarette butts to substitute for charcoal. Much of his art documents scenes from the past 3 years in Raqqa, people jailed or emaciated by hunger or trying to hide from bombs.
This drawing represents a child wearing a school bag. She couldn't find a blackboard to write on, so she wrote on a missile.
Another drawing is based on a brutal scene he once witnessed in Raqqa.
I saw a car stop, and a man was brought out. He was tied. When he started speaking, his captor started to hit him. They took him into their car and back out 5 minutes later. He was then taken to be executed. Usually, Islamic State executes people using a butcher's knife, but this man was shot with a gun.
Faisal did not want to give his real name or the location of his village because he was forced to leave behind a son who has been held by Islamic State for the past 3 years. Zlatica Hoc, VOA News, Washington.
And it is 20 minutes past the hour on International Edition.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
UN Refugee Agency is appealing for more than $400 million to support safe alternatives for tens of thousands of African refugees and economic migrants making the dangerous journey to North Africa and Europe. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says the number of refugees and migrants arriving in Europe from Africa through Libya is increasing, as is the number of deaths among those crossing the Sahara Desert and Mediterranean Sea. The UNHCR says 2,360 people have died or disappeared in the first 6 months of this year while making the perilous sea crossing to Italy. It says the number of deaths among those trying to reach Libya via the Sahara is even higher. UNHCR Special Envoy for the Central Mediterranean Situation, Vincent Costel, warns it is too dangerous for people to go to Libya. He says thousands of new arrivals are put in detention centers where they are abused and exploited.
We don't have access to that many people in Libya. So anything that we can do for the protection of the people, be they migrant or asylum seeker, everything we can do to provide them with alternative before they reach Libya is, in our view, a good thing.
The UNHCR is proposing a comprehensive strategy to end the deadly migratory flows. It includes setting up reception centers in the countries of origin and transit in sub-Saharan Africa, in North Africa, and in the destination countries in Europe. Costel says these centers will offer a variety of services. He tells VOA the UNHCR hopes to persuade refugees to stay in the countries of transit, where they will be able to have their cases and asylum claims examined.
Now, the outcome for those who might be recognized refugee will include facilitation of family reunion for those who have relatives elsewhere, and will include some resettlement.
Costel says it is hoped some people will forego the dangerous trek across the Sahara and choose to stay in the safe countries of transit if they see legal pathways toward asylum exist there. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, robots from around the world clashed in Washington, D.C. this week, and it's part of a global competition bringing high school students together to learn tech, but also to learn to cooperate to solve important problems. VOA's Steve Barragona reports.
It's part soccer match, part science exhibit, part United Nations. The first global challenge brought high schoolers from nearly 160 countries to Washington. They built robots to sort blue balls from orange ones and deliver them to different parts of the playing field. With its spirit of friendly international competition, it's like a robotics Olympics, but better, says founder Dean Kamen.
But the sports in the Olympics aren't the sports that will give kids the skill sets, the vision,
the courage, the technical expertise to take on the world's problems.
Kamen says these students are learning those problem-solving skills, along with the math, engineering, and programming prowess to be global tech leaders. But they also learn collaboration. Each match is 3-on-3. Teams have to cooperate to get the job done. Lita Azizi is with the Afghan team.
Every team has their own character to them. I can't say that we are good or they are good, but we are very excited and a bit nervous.
The Afghan team had extra challenges. An all-girl team in a male-dominated field from a country torn by conflict. Plus, their team was denied a visa twice. After an international uproar, President Donald Trump cleared them.
When we got rejected twice by the United States Embassy, we didn't feel defeated. We made our robot within 2 weeks, and we have our robot here. But we saw that God wanted us, and we got accepted. This time again, it is in God's hands. Whatever is in our destiny, but one thing is for sure, we will never lose our hope.
They did not win the most matches. Finland did. But that was never really the point, says Dean Kamen.
We've created a game where 160 robots are going to fight each other, and most of them will lose. But every kid that designed and built and sweated and worked over that robot has won.
Next year's competition will be in Mexico City. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
And we all know those robots are taking over. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. You can like us on Facebook at VOA Now. And, hey, follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us, everybody. I'm Philip Alexio. We'll see you tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In early July, President Donald Trump announced an additional nearly $639 million of humanitarian aid for the estimated 20 million people affected by food insecurity and violence in Somalia, South Sudan, and Yemen. Tens of millions of people are in need of humanitarian assistance as a result of the man-made crises in South Sudan, Nigeria, and Yemen, all of which are driven by violent conflicts. And in Somalia, where ongoing conflict is exacerbating the effects of severe and prolonged drought, said Acting Assistant Administrator for the USAID's Bureau for Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance, Robert Jenkins. Despite the influx of aid that has helped to alleviate famine in some areas of South Sudan, and has so far prevented famine in Yemen and Somalia, the overall food security situation is worsening, and life-threatening hunger continues to spread in both scope and in scale. In all four countries, conflict has been the primary driver of humanitarian need. In Somalia, conflict has made it difficult to reach some communities in dire need of food. In South Sudan and Yemen, civil wars have destabilized the economies, crippled agricultural production and trade, and sent the price of food skyrocketing. In Somalia and Nigeria, the regions that have been beset by violent terrorist groups, Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram and ISIS West Africa, respectively, are among those in the greatest need of humanitarian assistance. Through this additional funding, the United States can provide emergency food and nutrition assistance, life-saving medical care, improved sanitation, safe drinking water, emergency shelter, hygiene and health programs to treat and prevent disease outbreaks, and protection for civilians who've been affected by conflict, including both those displaced internally and as refugees. This additional funding brings the total U.S. contribution to over $1.8 billion in humanitarian assistance for the four famine crises since the beginning of fiscal year 2017, said Mr. Jenkins. We will continue to work with our international and local partners to provide this life-saving aid needed to avert famine and to support communities impacted by these crises.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.